Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's April 26th, 2015, and welcome to episode 99 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and complaining about links on Atari Age. Here with me today on this triangular table from Canada, we have I'm Paul Hagstrom in Boston, and from Canada we have Carrington Vanson. How are you, Carrington?
I am from Canada, and I am fantastic.
I am surprised.
I am shockingly reasonable.
And laughing in Sweden, joining us from there is Jack Nutting. How are you, Jack?
I'm doing pretty good. A little bit tired. I've been outside doing stuff in the sunshine, which is always exhausting.
I don't understand that sentence
at
all.
It's weird.
Watch out for yellowing.
In my case, it's watch out for reddening and then bursting into flaming.
You should see what happened to my space bar today. Ooh. Those are the worst ones, right? Those are the most affected by the sunlight.
or either that or not. There is always something. I think this has come up before, yeah. but there's always something that's really just bizarre about the coloring of the space bar with respect to all the other keys. Yes, but anyway. So I don't know. Have we talked enough about the weather?
Probably.
You talk more about that yellowing because it drives me crazy. The space bar thing. It's the reason I don't want one of the later Apple IIc models that are an always better than the earlier Apple IIc models. Not the C plus, but just the 2C, because the better keyboard, all of that. But that keyboard, in particular, the spacebar just goes bonkersly different than the rest of it. And I'm way too OCD to enjoy that, to look down and see that, like, that discoloration drives me crazy. So I click away on an older Apple IIc instead, just because of that. I'd rather suffer, but like it aesthetically.
Yeah, I know. I've seen that on Macs too. So the early Macs, the spacebar will be some funny color as well. With the solution is to have one of those Bell and Howell black Apple IIs, you know, because the keys are black. You know, they don't discolor.
But maybe just that the spacebar is the key that is most likely to have to need to be replaced because people are slamming on it for different purposes.
I think it's actually the bromide or something. Chemically, they're different. I thought.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah, I think they must be produced in some
way. Or maybe it's the only one that didn't discolor. I guess I'm jumping to the conclusion that all the rest of the keys are accurate, but majority doesn't mean accuracy.
How true, how true.
Fight the power! Rise up, other keys!
Okay, so anyway, today's topic was suggested in listener feedback, and we will go to further listener feedback later, but Charles wrote in and suggested that, you know, there has been some discussion lately among the retro computing enthusiasts about introducing the next generation, like the kids, to the computers and software of our youth. And of course, you know, part of that is that, you know, if interest in these things is going to last, they have to be interested in it, because at some point we're not going to be around. If they're going to live, if the machines we love and the, you know, topics we love are going to live on after we're gone, it would have to be in the hands of people who didn't have them growing up, and they wouldn't have their own nostalgia for them like we do. So, you know, one approach to this is to try to get your kids into it, you know, instill some kind of nostalgia for the early games, learn how to program on an Apple IIc, that sort of thing. This is the topic. The question was basically, is it working? Did it work? And thinking back on things your parents might have tried to instill in you of their own nostalgia, did that work? You know, I don't know, Jack, you might have had some experience with this. Like, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, well, I have, of course, shown my kids old video games and old computers and stuff. And I can't say that it has sparked an interest in either of them, really, in this stuff for its own sake. Although my younger daughter does sometimes, she will take out my Atari 130XE and hook up to the TV and play a game or two when I'm even not home, which is a good sign. And nothing is broken yet. And she and one of her friends have had a good time playing Star Raiders and stuff. So it's, you know, I think they can see the fun of it, but at the same time, you know, they're so, like, for them, a computer is something different, and a computer is what they have in front of them right now, and it's so convenient and has YouTube and has all the stuff they want to do. So I think that, well, I don't know, in a way it would almost be, I think they might be more inclined to be interested in these things if they were more substantially different than what they have in front of them. It's like, because they can see, okay, I've got this computer, and Dad's got this old computer, and it doesn't do anything except play a few games, and they're pretty slow to load and all this stuff. So, like, I think that they don't, for them, it's like, it would be probably easier for me to get them interested in some other hobby that was, you know, something that I'm not interested in. But if I were, like, something that was very, very different, like, for them, it's so similar in a way that it's just like, yeah, whatever. And I think that, like, I think about, to my parents, the only thing that I recall them being nostalgic for at all when I was a kid was music. Like, they would like to sing old songs from when they were younger and stuff and play old records. And I was always just like, ah, you know, we have the music we have now. Isn't that good enough? Like, what's so interesting about this old music? And so to me, it seems like, I guess, no, it's not working. Nostalgia is doomed.
Yeah.
Interesting. And thus ends the podcast.
Good night, everybody.
Now that we realize it's futile.
Yeah, we made it to 99, I guess. But Bill Carrington, what's your take on that?
Well, my family wasn't like a nostalgic family. My parents, I don't think, other than maybe music, but even then, they didn't try to get me into the music of their youth. Like my mom and dad would never sit down and say, you know, when I was a kid, we had better music and Casual Racism, and you should feel good about that or something. No, it was none of that. There's also, I guess, the issue of the difference between the whole medium and the message business. So if you're really into old music, it doesn't necessarily mean you'll be really into old records and the scratchiness, or maybe vice versa. Maybe you're really into albums and album art and you love handling vinyl, but you don't necessarily want to listen to 1920s crooners or something. Old computers kind of are of a piece, unless you try to get kids into it via emulation instead. And maybe instead of saying, hey, here's an old clunky 25-pound computer that's noisy and heavy and awkward to work with, let me show you LoadRunner. You can maybe skip all that and say, hey, let's put LoadRunner through via emulation on your kid's laptop or watch or embedded, you know, cranial computer or whatever the kids are into nowadays. So maybe there's ways to impart nostalgia rather than focusing on the thing itself. I have a love of the industrial design of the early 80s and the computers in that period. So I'm into retro computers as much for the physical computer as the thing you can do on it. I like both of them, but I think maybe I'd have to think of them separately when it comes to imparting nostalgia. My parents didn't really impart any of that onto me, but they were big enablers. They encouraged my love of computers and electronics, even though neither of them were into it, either then or as a kid. But it was the same with encouraging me in science and travel and reading, like, you know, all the good stuff. And so they were huge enablers. So in that sense, I owe my current retro computing nostalgia to them directly, because they were the ones who enabled and encouraged me to use and learn computers in the first place. But in no way were they into tech themselves. I was always just, you know, their nerdy computer kid. I've tried to do it with my nephew. I don't have kids myself, but I have a nephew, and I have introduced him to retro games, gaming consoles, old computers, and all of that. And he's always found it interesting and quaint for the one exposure. We'll sit down, let me show you an Atari 2600. How interesting. And 15 minutes later, he's done with it. And it hasn't stuck in any way. So I really don't have any effective advice to give others. And now my nephew's 18, so he's a lost cause. He's no longer interested. So, but maybe others can learn from my mistakes. I don't know. What I did didn't work. And I will be using these things long term. So there'll still be one listener of RCR as long as I'm still like around. But that's all I got to offer.
Yeah. Yeah. It does sort of seem like you can encourage the, you know, next generation to make better humans, or you can try to save the metro computers, but it's not actually clear that, I guess I'm sort of thinking that maybe this kind of interest is something that would by now have to be kind of more intellectual and something that's a little bit more, you come to it later trying to see how you got to where you are today, that kind of thing.
See, with a lot of nostalgic things that a parent might be into, like you might have a dad who's super into the cars of his youth, and so you spend a couple of summers rebuilding an old 1950s car with him, and then you finally go off to university and he throws you the keys and that's what you drive it, and that's cool, and that car will get you dates and so everything's good. But if the same thing happened and it was, say, my kid, and we spend a couple of summers in the garage rebuilding a Coco 3, when he goes off to university, I won't say, here, kid, here's your 8-bit, off you go. And he goes, oh, this will be great. Dad takes the university and flunks out miserably, and everyone makes fun of him. So not all nostalgia is equal, I think. Basically, what I'm saying is the stuff that got me beat up in high school, I don't want to necessarily pass on to my kids.
Right. Yeah. I mean, another thing that I was thinking about, as I think, Jack, you were talking about this, that maybe rather than, say, playing Loadrunner or whatever, that actually doing something like a Raspberry Pi type project or an Arduino type project, except with a computer from the 80s, might be a way in. You know, it's still never going to bring the same kind of, you know, memories of sitting in the dark, you know, dialing BBSs,
right.
Setting up all night downloads and that kind of thing. You know, that's no one would put up with that now.
No, those things are gone forever.
I do think that's a really good point, though. I mean, in all seriousness, Paul, because the things that drew me to computers originally back in the 80s that I loved and still love because of my personal nostalgia, but those things were not about the limitations. It is the case that if a wormhole had opened and pretty much any modern computer made in the last year popped back in time and landed on my desk in 1982, that would have been the end of my Apple IIs. I would have been like, screw those, look at this thing. My love was for the tech and what it enabled and the hacking, you know, mentality and just like the maker mentality and all of that. That kind of thinking and that love absolutely is something you can pass on. So like an Arduino or a Raspberry Pi is a great way to do that, because the Raspberry Pi is very much like today's version of those old 8-bits. That it, you know, it's relatively low powered, but you can do a lot with it. And you can fully control it. You can maybe even kind of fully understand it in a way that you couldn't understand a more complicated system. And it enables a lot of makering. And so that, I think, is a direct parallel. And absolutely, you could impart that love, that love of hacking, the love of making, the love of experimentation and programming and all of that could be imparted. And you could also talk about how you learned it on older systems or something. So you maybe slip the nostalgia in there. But the meat of it, like the thing that we actually liked about these in the first place, is still something you could probably pass on.
Yeah. And I think actually, you know, if you set these things up to interact with the outside world, that's still... There's still a certain kind of magic to that. I mean, you know, it's even if you're used to carrying your iPhone around and, you know, whatever, you know, looking at YouTube videos on the laptop and all this, I mean, it's still not quite the same as, you know, making a bunch of lights blink or a little robot walk across the room and stop or something, you know. So
when you enable it, yeah, absolutely. When you make up a system and then you press a button and because of what you did, the robot moves or the Coke comes out of the machine or the neighbor yells, you know, or whatever, that is exciting.
Yep, that's true. I think that I remember once upon a time, many, many years ago now, when I first had set up Wi-Fi in our house and, you know, sitting with a laptop somewhere doing stuff. And my wife reacted not to the fact that we had, you know, internet access that we could do whatever, you know, from the laptop that was not plugged into anything, but that I could print from it. Like, wait, you can make the printer across the room do something with no cables? Like, that was more exciting than... that I had the internet with no cables. And so there's something that, again, that ties back to the thing where just being able to do something that has an effect on something else in its vicinity, like you can see, okay, I did this, it made this thing happen, is very concrete compared to, like all everything you do back and forth on the internet is sort of like people take it for granted. It's like, yeah, whatever. It's like the telephone. It's like, yeah, sure. There's stuff out there and it comes back to me when I ask for it, whatever. Whereas when you can make something, like I said, make lights blink, make things happen in your room, that's more interesting.
So I guess that's the solution. We have landed on it.
Yes.
Using some kind of tech, get kids to interact, make them interact with the outside world in some way. I don't know. We'll see. We'll see. You know, if anyone's still listening to RCR 999, or
what people are nostalgic for the earlier RCRs.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I guess actually it's true. Probably first 10 are starting to become retro already. Okay. So I guess we can move on. We get to apart from that suggestion over feedback, and thank you for that. We had a couple of other things that came in on the feedback wire, and we'd sort of let some of these go for a while, but so Yorma wrote in to talk about the we had mentioned, no, I forgot what it was called, but the VTech 200 was a computer that came up a couple of times ago on as an eBay auction, and then Michael confirmed that actually this is the same thing that he has one of them, and they sold them in Australia under some different name. I forget, maybe Dick Smith 200 or something like that. So Yorma wrote to confirm that VTech made computers for all kinds of people. And he actually, we'll have a link in the show notes here somewhere, but he had a link to a computer that he is sort of interested in finding called the Celora Manager. I'd never heard of this before, but I think it is a Finnish computer, but it's really cool looking. The 6502 machine that VTech was responsible for creating. So anyway, you can follow the link in the show notes to see this.
It's a neat computer. I'd never heard of it either. And it's a funny combination of like really good specs and kind of disappointing specs for its time. So this came out in 1884. So some things, I like the fact that it's a 6502, but it's weird that it's a 6502A rather than a C. It runs at 2 megahertz, which is decent, but not great for 1984. And it comes with 32 kilobytes of RAM, though. And 32K is kind of low for 84, but it is a 16-color machine with 256 by 192 graphics, according to this site. So that's a decent resolution of color graphics for the age. So it's got like multi-channel sound, and like some things about it I really like, and I really like the look of the keyboard, and the industrial design is kind of cool. And other things, I think I would have been banging up against that RAM ceiling and wishing for maybe something a little faster or a little slightly more tricked out 6502 chip, given the year it came out.
Yeah, so we wish him luck finding one, and we would like to hear about it, actually. But okay, continuing on, Brian wrote back, you know, so some time ago we talked a bit about, you know, like what do we do, how do we prepare for the point when we're no longer you know, sort of in control of our collections. And
there's a euphemism.
I'm running out of ideas of how to say this. But at any rate, so he wrote basically just to give a couple of sort of small list of ideas on this. And part of the reason that he wrote was just because he has some experience adapting legal documents for this purpose. And so, but he said basically, a couple of points that amounted to create a list of people with contact information and saying how each one might be able to help and possibly appoint somebody to have power of attorney over everything, or maybe this part of the, you know, your estate. And then create a will with a list of categories, at least, and most valuable things, who digital copies should go to, and possibly choose a museum as a recipient. On that point, I know that museums are not universally enthusiastic to get such things. You know, they may well not want 8 iMac G4s. You know, so I think a museum probably, it's great if a museum is looking for something to be able to provide it for them. But I think that it's likely that museums would not just generally take drop-offs.
You could also get maybe a little creative. Like if you had a bunch of Apple II stuff and say it wasn't necessarily worth a whole bunch, you didn't have anything that was a real standout, or you had a couple, so you indicated that those separately should be thrown on eBay or something. But then you've got the mass of your collection, which are things that you really enjoyed having and really appreciated, but frankly aren't worth a ton and probably not worth the effort to eBay or what have you. You could leave it to the Kansas Fest, you know, garage sale thing. and say, I want to leave it to that. Here's a gathering, and it will be just distributed into the community. And it would absolutely be appreciated, and people would grab stuff, and that'd be a quick way to distribute it. So you could do maybe something a little more creative than just a museum.
That is a good idea. Yeah, and I mean, I think for most, I would imagine for most of the things that people are collecting, there is some kind of community sort of equivalent to Kansas Fest. Kansas Fest is good for Apple II stuff. But I know there's, you know, the Cocoa meetings and I think so. I have already been sort of talking about how there aren't really Atari meetings, right? Is that true?
Boo Atari. Well,
there's the Atari party.
Yeah, there's an Atari meeting. There's the Atari meeting at Kansas Fest.
Yeah, right. there's really nothing like Kansas Fest for just Atari stuff. But there are plenty of people interested in Atari. And I think about the vintage computing groups that are around in different places that are, you know, sort of general purpose, not devoted to just one platform or another, that exists as well.
Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, maybe what, you know, part of what this needs to be is just that it's one of the people on the contact lists would be, you know, somebody that knows what the groups are. But,
right.
Yeah, no, I like that idea, actually. At Kansas Fest specifically, you know, every year there is kind of like a free-for-all time where I'm not actually sure where I think a lot of the equipment is sourced from one person, Sean. But
I have brought down things as well that I just sort of slip on. Last year I brought down a bunch of things and I just sort of slipped them onto the table and they all got taken. So it's a great way to just distribute stuff if you don't feel like selling it and you don't want to take responsibility. Sometimes I feel if I sell somebody something, especially if they're in the community, and it goes horribly wrong or deletes it or something, I'm going to feel guilty and I would rather just give it away, and I'd rather give it away anonymously. So I have found personally just placing things into that giveaway is a great way to abdicate responsibility but still distribute it into the community.
Yeah, no, that sounds good. And I should say, I know that there at least maybe it was last year or 2 years ago, there were a couple of other people who contributed stuff. And so, I mean, it's not all from one source, but yeah, that's generally at meetings like this. And so VCF, VCF East that just happened, and I think probably all of the VCFs generally have nothing. They don't have anything quite like this because they have a consignment area, but they still might know how to distribute stuff that doesn't have a dedicated meeting for it. Okay. Anyway, so thanks, Brian, for writing, and for writing again to remind us. let's see, some other feedback that we never got around to. Show number 81. We didn't mention the Coco 3. Sorry about that. 181. We'll talk about it.
When we swing back around and talk about 1981 again.
Right. Let's see. We got some comments. Andrew noted that we don't talk enough about Chuck Peddle. We should talk more about Chuck Peddle. We will try to talk more about Chuck Peddle. But he actually is one thing that's nice about him now is that he seems to be not shy about giving interviews. And so you can find him. You can find interviews from him, Earl. From our very own show, has I think a 3-part interview that he did on RetroBits, and there are other interviews that have been done. I think the Amp Hour did one. He was on something quite recently.
Oh, that's right.
So, anyway.
Oh yeah, Amp Hour did it. You're right. Just like last month or something.
Yeah, it was recent, and he's. Chuck Peddle is super entertaining to listen to. So,
mm-hmm. And Earl's interviews, and I think it was at least 2 parts. It was a multi-part one that Earl did, is a great interview as well. Like, I would highly, and Earl's not here, so we can talk him up. And I would highly recommend that one.
Right. And possibly related, recently, so I think we mentioned last time even, you know, Antic's been, the Antic podcast has been doing all these interviews, but one of them recently was someone from the Western Design Center who's the current producer of the 6502, you know, chip. So that's also I don't know if they talk much about Chuck Peddle in that interview, but at any rate, it's related.
Yeah, I think he mentioned Bill Mensch a bit more. I think Bill Mensch is one of the guys who actually founded that company, Western Design Center, and he probably still owns it. Mm-hmm. But we
could just start saying hello to Chuck Peddle. Like in every episode.
Hello.
Yeah. And welcome to the RCR. We want to say hello, Chuck Peddle.
And until next time. Right. and okay, so there's, I was going to track this down and didn't actually finish tracking it down. But Andy wrote in to point out a BBC4 radio series called Codes That Changed the World. And I'm not sure. A lot of times the BBC stuff is not, you know, it's on iPlayer or whatever, but it's not available easily outside of the UK. But at least I think it's a 5-part series, and there are, I think the first 3 episodes were Fortran, COBOL, and BASIC, you know, and so it's quite relevant. We'll see if we can get it. If you are in the UK, though, it might be worth listening to, at least while it's still available. And we will try to listen to it, too.
Oh, I absolutely will. I'm very pleased about this feedback. This looks fantastic.
So much better than any other feedback we got.
Well, no, I just didn't know about this. And it looks like Java is the one, boo, they picked as number 4. And oddly, Tower of Babel is number 5? I don't understand this. But regardless, I will definitely be listening to Fortran, COBOL, and BASIC. And we'll see if I continue from there. Yeah, this looks really interesting. Oh, I'm going to listen to this right after this episode.
So thank you, Andy, for keeping Carrington busy.
Totally. When in doubt, entertain Carrington.
Okay, so I think that we'll close out the listener feedback there. That's we've taken quite a bit of time already there. Thank you for writing in, though, and we will try to address future feedback in a little more timely way. Moving on to items of interest and news, Carrington, you can start with our legal discussions.
Yes, well, the ESA, boo to the ESA, that is the Entertainment Software Association, they have now come down and decided, after giving it much thought, they are putting the full weight of the ESA behind the idea that it should be illegal, or in their opinion, it is illegal, to hack or crack or in any way modify software or systems for like old games in particular here. They're talking about old console game, you know, PlayStation, Atari 2600, all of that. So in any way modifying anything to do with that ecosystem, specifically for the purposes of archiving, should be illegal. Now, they also think it should be illegal for everything else, but they want to make sure that the Copyright Office in the U.S. is taking a hard line against digital archiving of these things, that they're against it, that it would be far better, in their opinion, that these games are lost to time and are never played again and are not archived. That would be better than, you know, modifying any sort of system or making emulators available or what have you. It'd be better if they're lost than if they're archived, because, you know, copyright is that important. In my opinion, they can bite me. And that's pretty much what I have to say about that.
Yeah, that's not pleasant news. I mean, there's a sense in which I've always kind of thought, like, I've wondered about what the Internet Archive is doing, and like, you know, how why they aren't being gone after. I hope they can continue to not be gone after, though. I don't know what this means. I guess I don't know how official of an entity this ESA is.
Well, they're big in a sense, because they are a major force in the U.S. in particular, because they're basically a lobby group, but they're a very powerful one, because they're, you know, tons of funds are put into them by the manufacturers of current tech and people who push out, you know, modern games. And so they're like a ratings body, and, you know, just they're a big government force. And so they can have sway, and and they have huge, you know, massive deep pockets. So that's the bad thing. It's people like, you know, they're big pushers for, in the U.S. you've got the DMCA, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which can also, by the way, bite me. And so, you know, they're saying, hey, you should put the whole weight behind this. You should definitely sue any, you know, educational places, like if there's a museum or any sort of university that is in any way housing or enabling the playing or archiving of old games via emulations, you know, they really want to make sure that the Copyright Office goes and sues them. I mean, just like, they're definitely a force of evil. I hate the ESA so much. It worries me, because what happens in the U.S. often just sort of by default ends up happening up here in my country. So I'm a little afraid of this, and I just think it's short-sighted and stupid.
I guess I don't see what is the point of them doing this. I mean, no one is interested in trying to sell these old games. They're talking about things that are really very much end of life. And are they afraid that if people are playing these old games by re-enabling things in some way, even though servers are gone and stuff, that people will then stop buying new games? Is that what they're concerned about? Because it seems to me very unlikely. You know, the majority of the game industry is so driven by these big studios that want to have big hits with big games, which mostly seems to work, right? You know, EA sells God knows how many games based on, you know, kind of regurgitating a lot of the same formulas in terms of these shooters and things. But it works. And it's like, I don't think that the existence of old games is going to make these new games sell less. It just doesn't seem to work that way. I don't know.
Right. I think we already covered that the load runner is not preferred.
yeah, we open with. I think a lot of it is just about old games. They don't really think of it as a game. They think of it as a bit of IP, intellectual property. And so the characters from those games and what have you get brought forward to new games, or they want to remake a game or re-release a game, and they just don't want there to be any chance that maybe it would affect them economically. The thing that's always bothered me, though, is you want to have it both ways. And so it bothers me that you'd have any industry group saying, on the one hand, we want to physically lock everything down with DRM and put, you know, software or maybe even hardware barriers against copying, about using stuff. We're going to make the software talk back to a server so you can't use it if we're not authorizing you and what have you. And at the same time, we might shut down those servers anytime and then the game is lost to history. Or we're going to enable some sort of chipset that's going to just like self-destruct, or that system won't be available. So they physically stop you from being able to get access to things that you supposedly bought, and then they changed what buying means to just licensing. But then you get a game that's 30, 40 years old, and you just want to play it or save it because let's, you know, not lose this stuff to history. And so they say, well, let's enact laws that make it illegal to circumvent that DRM, even if it's on a 40-year-old game and it's trying to talk to a server that we own and we've shut down, and so we can't. And the whole thing is just such nonsense. I said bite me, right? That's the most important part of my stance is the bite me aspect.
On a related note, I saw an article recently about just this notion of IP in the form of software that is, you know, built into something you buy. In general, that companies are moving towards, they want to make it so that, okay, we can sell you a piece of hardware, but the software in it, you don't actually own it. You own the license to use it. And for instance, they're talking about this in terms of like, tractors. You can buy a John Deere tractor for your farm, and it's got software in it that you technically, legally, are not allowed to sort of hack and change the software that runs your tractor. And the concern is, you know, what happens if, you know, in 20, 30 years down the road, when I've still got this tractor, still using it, and I can no longer modify it legally, even because, you know, the service techs don't care about that old model anymore and whatever. And it's an interesting thing where, again, there, I think specifically this was a, like, John Deere was coming out and saying that people who modify our software to do anything different on their tractor are doing so illegally. And like,
and I see the thinking there, because they did this with printers. Printers a long time ago started putting ridiculous bits of software into the ink cartridges. They said, oh, now you can't refill the ink cartridge. It's not fair. You're going around our copyright that we put into this piece of plastic, and we put in that software only to stop you from being able to really, it has no purpose other than to make it illegal to refill it, because we want to sell you a quarter of an ounce of ink for $45.
Even if we, you know, then go out of business.
Yes, and then too bad for you. And the idea that you don't own the things that you buy, that you just take a lease from a company, and you cannot modify it, and you cannot do all the things that we used to love, like that we started talking about. Hey, you know, you go into your garage, and if you are cool and your dad's cool, then you rebuild a car. If you are me and my kid, then you instead rebuild an old computer. But whatever, we're both rebuilding things that you would enjoy and love, and that whole notion would be removed, because you say, oh, well, you can't work on that because that car is software. You know, it has an expired license or what have you. That might be the way to fight against this. So maybe the EFF should have a television campaign that talks about, hey, you're rebuilding the car with your dad. Screw you. John Deere hates America and says Americans shouldn't work on their cars. Why does John Deere hate American children? So maybe that would be the EFF. You know, you can have that one, that from me to you, EFF.
Perhaps some clips from whatever it is, Maximum Overdrive, and you know, complaints about viruses and things can also be.
I like that movie. You got to admit, I dig that movie.
The idea of a tractor getting a virus, though, is really quite pleasing.
But one of the things they were also saying in their press release was there was concern that if you hack the software in your tractor, you might actually be able to use that to do things like pirate music. Like, I guess the idea you'd maybe have like a torrent client running on your tractor. I don't know.
I like a torrent tractor. I like the idea that I go out and I till one field, but I'm actually tilling like 5,000 other fields at the same time. I torrent my farm. Anyway, this is a retro podcast. This is why we're not allowed to have a modern tech podcast. Right. We're curmudgeons.
Anyway, well, it's good to know the news. Maybe something can be done about it. I was going to say, maybe it's going to just turn out to be illegal. Illegal, like exceeding the speed limit on the highway is illegal. Well, one might hope. But, okay, moving on. Jack, you have an interesting blog to report.
Yes, I do. So Jimmy Maher, who is the author of a book called The Future Was Here, about the Commodore Amiga. This book came out a couple of years ago. I've not read this book yet, but I've been meaning to. It's been kind of on my list of I ought to buy this. Every time I see it, I think, oh, I ought to buy that book. Anyway, he has a couple of interesting blog posts, and these are about what he's calling the 68,000 wars. Specifically, he's talking about the 68,000 CPU as used in the Atari ST and in the Commodore Amiga, and kind of the whole story of what happened in this period of time, 1983, 1984, when Atari and Commodore kind of like changed ownerships, and Jack Tramiel, who was the head of Commodore, left and bought up Atari and the various teams who were working on different pieces of technology that went into these different systems. Pretty interesting read. I've only read the first half of them. This is a two-part article series. They're both quite lengthy, but the first half at least was well worth reading. I'm going to read the second half one of these days. I'll get around to it.
And there's even a third half.
Oh, there's a third half. I didn't catch that. All right, cool. All the halves. Read every half you can find.
Yeah, so I also haven't quite finished reading this, but I have been super impressed with the stuff that is, you know, that I have read on Jimmy Maher's site. I mean, he tends to look a fair amount at interactive fiction and things, you know, the development of Infocom titles and that sort of thing. But it's super great depth and super well written. And so read these and then read everything else that he's written.
Just read all the things.
Come back. Yes. Okay. Great. Let's see. I will move on to something else. So I don't actually know what the status of this is right now, but a couple of days ago, as of when we're recording, there was a post called some activity on Twitter and whatever. There was apparently a game called Wander from 1974, a lost mainframe game has been found. So there's a post on the most linked to post that I'm aware of right now is on ahopeful.wordpress.com, and so it speaks about basically, you know, seeing some references to an early game, or actually I think this is more of a, it's kind of like an adventure game creating system, kind of like the Inform system that and it's actually supposed to predate the Colossal Cave and so forth. And so there were some references to it somewhere. And ultimately, the end of the story, as I understand it, is that somebody said, you know, I'd like to find this, and just wrote to the author. And the author looked around a little bit and said, oh, here it is, and sent a, you know, archive. But it is sort of interesting, you know, that, from what I could tell from reading this, this has been, you know, people have been looking for this for a long time. I'm not quite sure why it took this long to actually consider emailing the person who's credited for writing it. But it's neat to, at any rate, it's neat that it's out there in principle. One thing that I have not seen is actually the code. I've seen the reports that the code has been.
Oh, it's on it's on GitHub.
Is it? Okay.
I'll stick a link in our show notes because I went and grabbed it.
Ah, okay, good. Yes, because, I mean, that was one of the things. It seems like, great, you know, I'm looking forward to seeing this, but all I had seen up until now was this screenshot of the man page.
So I've grabbed it, and what's exciting is it supposedly, the version 3, which is the one on GitHub at the moment, does compile under a modern version of OS 10. And so I am really excited to play it, to play with it. I, as a lover of interactive fiction, Infocom games, etc., and especially early interactive fiction, I'm really, really excited about this because this isn't just a super early game. It's maybe the earliest version of a game making, not really engine, but a game making system in a sense. So it was designed not just to play a game, but to play multiple games and to enable those. And so there are available a bunch of downloadable, what they call worlds. So it would be a Wander world that you can then play through. So it's like an entire gaming system has been found. Very, very exciting.
Yeah. And I think that part of the thing that's very cool about this is that it is so early that we might be able to see the beginnings of things that took off later, you know.
Well, I just want to read the source code because I've always wanted to, and I've dabbled with a bit of code in making my own version of an interactive fiction, you know, system, just so that I can write my own games in it for the Apple II. And I so quickly run out of memory if I want to have a large dictionary. So there's got to be a much better way to do this than I've come up with. So I'm looking to steal other people's ideas. So I look forward to stealing much from Wander.
Excellent.
Well, you know, along those lines, there was a good interview with Scott Adams on, I think it was the Antic podcast also, back to that again, a few weeks ago, where he talked, basically what he did was he had sort of a, like, the game itself was compiled into kind of a database, like a binary database. And on each platform he ran the game on, he just kind of had an interpreter that knew how to read that database format.
Yeah, and Infocom basically did the same thing. I have just not been able to do it in a way that is
okay.
Good. and I want to do it. My problem is I don't want to do Scott Adams style games. I find that the one or two word inputs too limiting. I want to have a very large dictionary so you can use a lot of synonyms.
Sure.
I found in the Scott Adams games, which are great fun, but it's a lot of, you know, hunt the verb going on because it'll be the one particular, no, you must say this word, none of the 300 words in English that mean basically the same thing. So I want to have a lot of synonyms and I want to have full sentence parsing. Mm-hmm. For my first one. And I want to ideally be able to have a 16K deployment target. so far, I have just failed miserably. And so, but there's got to be a way to, I don't know, I'm not skillful or intelligent enough to figure this out, but I will become more skillful and more intelligent by stealing from Wander.
Excellent. I think, actually, if I'm not mistaken, Infocom, or at least, some of these, only parse the first couple letters of a command. So,
yeah, I think it's the first five.
Yeah. Oh, okay. That's more than I thought, actually. That's good.
Well, so you can have, because like inventory,
you want to kill somebody and then kick them.
Right. Yes. So I think it's the first five letters. I've done a few things that have helped a lot. Cramming like two letters into, or three letters into two bytes, little things like that I then found out that Infocom was doing, and they did it a better way than I'm doing, so I've changed my way of compressing that down. If you only need 7 bits, you can get things. I was like, I don't need 7 bits, I need 5 to do the letters I need. And so you can play a lot of compression games, but it's more the logic behind it, like understanding if somebody says, you know, put the hat with the feather on the hook. Do you mean the hat with the feather goes on the hook, or you put the hat along with the feather on the hook? Or like, just like, there's always many ways to interpret English that I make it too complicated and then I give up and I rage quit.
And speaking of that, not rage quitting or English, but
speaking of that, I'm gone.
I'm just doing this from memory. I didn't link this in, so I'll try to find a link for it. But there was a early sort of language parsing system called, I think, Shrewdlu, which was supposed to basically, this is Shrdlu, and I'm not completely sure. I think it did work once in a demo. You know, it's a sort of academic project more than anything else. But I think you would talk to it and it would interact within a very small world of blocks and triangles and stuff like that. So you could say, put the block in the box, and it would know how to do this. And it would give you some representation of the world. This is like, you know, MIT in the 70s or something, I believe. Anyway, it's lookupable, and there'll be a link in the show notes once it's figured out. Okay, anyway, speaking of games, Carrington, you have the next thing.
Kaboom! Kaboom, I say. I'm excited to talk about this strictly because I think this will be another example of this podcast getting to talk about an Apple II thing before Open Apple can. Suck it, Quinn and Mike. We beat you again. So Kaboom, it was released recently by, in fact, we could have talked about this last show. So that's how slow they are. Mm-hmm. So Kaboom from Ninja Force Entertainment. Really, really slick game. So it's an Apple II GS game, and it's basically Bomberman, but it's four players can play. I think it's four players simultaneously. It's crazy awesome. Like, the graphics are amazing, and you know, the sound, all of it. It's just such a slick implementation. And what I like about it is they made a great game and didn't allow themselves to really be limited by the Apple II GS. It'll play on a stock 2GS, but really it wants 2 megs of RAM, which is a little rare for a stock, like, you know, back in the day 2GS. And it wants you to have an accelerator, and we'll take advantage of it. So I like the idea that games will start to come out and say, you know what, this is the 2015s. There'll be more than one 2015s. There'll be 5 or 6 of these years. And a lot of people with a retro computer have way more RAM in them than they would have had back in the day. So unlike me and my 16K target, why not target 2 megs and up? Why not target, like, you know, 6 megahertz and up or something? And so Kaboom is a great example of a developer saying, let's make a game that will run on an older 2GS, but let's really take advantage of what a current 2GS target would actually be. And it's amazing. Like, it's just shockingly good. Love this game. Really excited about it. So you can download it, play it. It's super sweet, and we will have a link in the show notes.
Excellent. I have not tried this yet, I am looking forward to trying it out. Have you tried it in emulation?
I have. In fact, I've only played it in emulation.
Okay. So it's possible.
Oh, no, sorry. No, I have. By only in emulation, I mean not in emulation.
Excellent.
So, but I'm going to be playing in emulation because my 2GS doesn't have an accelerator. And I was over at my friend Roberta's when the only time I've played it, we played a multiplayer, and she has some sort of, you know, make fast card inside her 2GS. So I don't even know what it was, but she had said, yeah, that she's, you know, zipping along quicker than it should be. And the game was super crazily impressive. I would assume it will run great under something like Sweet 16, but I haven't actually tried it yet.
Okay. Yeah, I'll have to try it. I'm embarrassed today. I have a Transwarp GS, and I haven't even plugged it in yet.
Look at this guy.
I mean, I got it at Kansas Fest last year. I'll try it. I'll plug it in and try this out. Let's see. What's next? Jack, you're next.
Yes. I've got something here. This is a bit of interesting technology that was recently shown at the Vintage Computer Festival East, which we can't really report about that. It's already happened. I guess we could report about what happened there if any of us had been there and witnessed it. But one thing that did happen is apparently this thing was shown. This is a big honking analog computer. It doesn't have a name. It's been dubbed George because the name of the guy who built it was George A. Philbrick. This was built specifically for MIT as sort of a one-off thing. It's an interesting, it kind of looks like what you would see in an old movie showing what computers look like. Like, it's like just a huge mass of interesting looking knobs and stuff. A big orange screen that does who knows what. So they have this thing all assembled, but not working. It looks like a cool thing, and apparently this was on display again at VCF East lately. And while we're talking about this, I wanted to also mention that VCF Southeast is coming up this next weekend, May 2nd and 3rd. So assuming this podcast goes up before that, if you have a chance, you should go head out to VCF Southeast.
What I like about VCF East is you can read it as VC Feast.
Yeah.
And that pleases me.
I every single time I see that is the first way I parse that.
It's bizarre because me too. Oh, we're going to be at the VC Feast. We shall feast upon VCs. This George computer, though, is sweet and beautiful and a perfect example of what looks like, you know, World War II big iron. Like, it's just, it's great.
Yeah, it is really nice.
There's also a really, in the, I think this will be the link that goes in the show notes. This it doesn't just show George. There's a whole scrollable bunch of photos. You can see other photos from the event, including a photo which delights me because it's got the Heathkit Hero 1, the little robot, which is my favorite of the 80s robots. I adore it, and I wish I owned one. So it's just nice to see a photo.
Yeah, that is it is really – it is very cute looking. It looks oddly like a baboon.
But okay. Had never thought of that before, but
you
see
will never
it,
be
yes.
able to look at this yep. again and not see the baboon.
I have to paint the back of it like bright red.
Right, exactly. It is cute though. I was at the Info Age Museum, I don't know, a year and a half ago or something, and it was, you know, exactly right here in the, as in the picture, just hiding under the little shelf. In fact, under Heathkit 3400, I think, is what that little blue the blue thing is above it. But yeah, they're very cute. I would love to have one, but they you don't see them for sale very often, and when you do, they're missing panels.
And they're outrageous even if they are missing stuff. They go for so much money.
Yeah. Okay, let's see. So the ARM chip is reaching its 30th year. I think this is, you know, I'm not sure exactly when in the year it happened, but so there's a series of videos that Computerphile has been posting. Their videos, interviews with, well, not exactly interviews because they're not, there's no interaction. It's just Steve Ferber talking about the, you know, sort of beginnings of the ARM chip. And this, the particular one that just showed up, I think there are going to be three, and this particular one was really about kind of designing the ARM, and I forget when this was. It was early 80s, 83, 84, or something like that. And this, the ARM chip, of course, is the one that went on to be in everybody's phone. But the interviews are really interesting. It's worth listening to. You can listen for how the 65816 inspired the chip that is now on everybody's phone. Just because I think actually the bit of the interview where he talks about that is the inspiration is, you know, he went to visit the makers of the 65816, and it turned out, you know, it's just sort of like a little operation in a garage, basically, and, you know, figured if they can do it, we can do this too. So,
cool.
Okay. So yes. Anyway, go see that, and go see the ones preceding and post-seeding it, and then all of the other Computerphile videos, because they're all pretty interesting.
You're looking at a small portable computer called the IBM 5100. It's helping a lot of different people do their work more productively.
Managing real estate investments entails many difficult decisions. Do I pay it now or later? What about the landscaping? Can we afford it? What about taxes? There are many, many difficult decisions to make. It's really nice having a computer to help.
It weighs about 50 pounds. You can plug it in anywhere.
Bad weather, late deliveries, construction delays of all kinds.
How is it going to affect our schedule?
Now we can find that out fast.
The 5100 can help handle some very complex information.
Jet fuel is expensive. At Siemens Precision, we're developing a product that'll help the pilots save fuel. Flight test time is also expensive. But we do our flight tests right here in the lab on our 5100 and save time and money.
Capacity? About the same as some large computers a few years ago.
We're a mid-sized life insurance company. If we want to compete, and we do, we've got to be flexible. We've got to get answers fast. This little machine will help us do it.
The 5100 is easy to learn and simple to use.
There are countless combinations of feed we can mix. What is the most economical for any particular herd? That's what I'm figuring out now.
The cost of the 5100 is reasonable. It's bringing the advantages of the computer to more and more people. IBM, helping put information to work for people.
Okay, and we're back from commercial now. So the beginning of the buying portion of the show is the retro computing gift idea. And so we had a sort of powwow about this ahead of the show, and suddenly landed on what looks to be a perfect thing. It is called Retro-re. It's being sold by somebody in a forum post on Atari Age, but the picture is beautiful. It comes in a box styled just like the Atari 2600 games, and says Retro-re video game memo. And inside, it's basically a bunch of cards with, you know, sort of pixely icons on them that you use to play a sort of, you know, memory style game. So it looks wonderful though, and there's some pictures on Atari Age. The way you order is by emailing somebody and then sending 40 euros or $45 US. And so this, I think anybody who is sort of at all into retro gaming or retro computers would think this is really cool. I am fairly certain.
I also like the way the game's going to play, whereas you don't get, like a normal memory match game, you turn over two cards, they're identical, so they match. Here, it'll be two different sprites or two different icons from the same game. So you have to know the game. So there'll be two things from, say, Adventure. And you, oh, those are a match because they're both from Adventure. But if you don't know the game, you won't necessarily know that they're a match. And I think that's kind of cool. And the first 40 people that order get to pick a game that will be included. So I don't know if he's reached 40 orders yet, though, because the whole thing is so weird and you order by DMing. Like, it's all very strange, but it looks beautiful.
Yeah, it is. It is great. Jack found it.
Yep, I found it. Quite the thing.
Oh, and it looks like they have done the final pieces, so too late to become one of those people.
So this, you can get this and you can play it with your kids and, you know, beat them soundly until they start doing their research on the 2600. Motivate them into retro gaming.
That's right. Is that how we get them into the show? I don't think it is.
Force them to learn these pairs of arbitrary pixely figures. Don't you know your Warlords characters when you see them?
This squiggle clearly goes with that squiggle. Don't you know your pile of blocks?
Anyway, so looking forward to seeing that. If anyone gets it, let us know how it went. Okay, and so we can now turn to further spending of money on eBay. Carrington, you have the first one.
I do. Well, then I'm going to pick something that will have expired by the time people hear this show, but will have been reposted because it's something that comes up quite a bit, and I'm surprised I haven't selected it before. In fact, I may have selected it before, but I don't think so. So here you go. And I've been more interested in this because I recently picked up an SE30. Now, one of the problems with the Toaster Macs, those old styles, the original, you know, the Fat Mac and the SE30, the SE, all of those, the Plus, etc., is there's a single slot. And so you have to select, like, are you going to try to soup it up and put an accelerator in, or are you going to add, like, say, Ethernet ability? Like, and it's like, pick. You can have one of these two. Well, no more. For $200 US, there is something called the Stratos SE30 dual slot PDS adapter. So you plug this thing in, and it lets you run two cards, squeeze two cards into your SE30. So, for instance, you can throw in an 040 card from Daystar and give yourself a 68040 chip, and nice and speedy, and that's excellent. And also plug in, say, like a Dana or a Farallon Etherport thing. So you have Ethernet and a faster computer. Best of both worlds. Cost you $200 though, so it's not super cheap, but adds a whole bunch of functionality. It's sold on eBay just as a buy it now thing, and every once in a while, like in this case, it'll be done in 2 days and then it'll just get relisted. Like, they're actually manufactured to order. So I think it's super cool. I want to get one, probably will shortly, and that is my selection for my eBay pick.
Yeah, I've looked at these before. The seller is the same one who makes the Aztec Monster and Power Monster, compact flash solutions for. They work in the SC30s. They're basically SCSI to compact flash converters. Also somewhat expensive, but I mean, I think it is a complex technology.
That's how I found this thing, because I've been looking to replace the SCSI drive inside my woefully noisy SE30. So I want to replace the fan. I definitely want to replace the SCSI drive with something else. And I want to I want to change as much of the inside as possible. So it looks like for roughly, you know, $350, this one company can give me a couple of key pieces to that solution.
Actually, and now I'm looking at so if you look at the other listings from ArtMix, which is the person who makes these, the Aztec Monster is actually not very expensive, not nearly as expensive as I remember it being. It's just under $110. So, interesting. I think I paid a lot more for mine. Oh, well.
Well, there's other, or maybe you got a different one. There's other solutions out there, but I hear good things about the Aztec Monster one. So I think that's what I'm going to pick up as my SCSI to CF solution. Although I've also been looking at a different thing that's a SCSI to SD card solution. And I kind of prefer SD things to compact flash cards because I really just don't play in compact flash world that much.
Yeah, I find it actually kind of hard to find compact flash cards. So,
cool. I mean, I don't need a lot. Really, you just use one for any particular device. I'll just leave it inside the SE30 and say, there you go. It's just its own thing. But if I feel like 5 or 6 years from now, or even just a couple of years from now, if I have difficulty with a card dying, it's going to be much easier to replace an SD card than to find a CF card. Like, and the further we go into the future, the more difficult it's going to be to track down CF cards. Because the thing that I desperately, what I actually want is to be able to plug an Apple, like a disk 2 drive, into a modern Mac. I need a disk 2 to USB solution so I can use actual disks on an emulator and my life will be happier.
Oh, you know, this came, I think this came up last time, or this came up a time recently. The CryoFlex and things like that do this, I think, even now.
Yeah, but I'm not going to get one of those.
Okay. All right. I just was thinking, you know, last time whenever it was that this happened, I was thinking, oh, I should have said something. But anyway, now I've said something. It doesn't matter.
And you got shot down.
Okay.
You with your problem solving. We're here to complain.
Exactly.
Okay, Jack. You have the next
yes,
one.
Yes, I found something cool looking, I think. This is an Atari-style USB joystick controller. It's basically, it looks like they have taken something, molded something very, very similar to the classic Atari 2600 joysticks, made it a USB joystick, which is not that unique in and of itself. But what is kind of unique about this one, as far as I've seen, it's got these really cool blue LED lights inside of it, which, in my opinion, blue LEDs inside of anything has got to be good. The pictures make it look pretty cool, and I think the fact that since blue LEDs are still sort of new-ish compared to the other LEDs. Like, when we were kids, there weren't a lot of blue LEDs at all. Maybe there weren't any.
I don't know if these are blue LEDs. I think it's clear LEDs inside a blue case.
So?
I think you can make anything a blue LED if you stick blue in front of it.
Could be. Yeah, it's hard to be sure.
I could be wrong.
I feel like looking at
the lights look pretty,
these photos.
Yeah, the lights look pretty blue.
They look
yeah.
pretty blue. And, like, when you see the part of the controller stick sticking up above it that is not so much lit up, you see the background through it, and it looks not blue. So,
and the description does distinctly, though, say blue LED. So it could be, I think that's on your side of the argument here. And yet, maybe they just mean this is blue, and it has LEDs.
Could be.
Maybe there's a missing comma, but I think maybe you're right here.
Anyway.
Oh, it doesn't even ship to Canada. Screw this auction.
No shipping to Canada. Yeah.
It looks cool, though. It occurs to me that something like this, so if I'm not mistaken, these joysticks are in fact just four-way, right? Like, so, and not analog. It's just like it's either up is either on or
that's
off.
That's right. Yeah. So these are not really appropriate for Apple II games, but for most any other retro computer games or console games, that sort of thing. This should be pretty.
I've been attempting to build a controller for an Apple II, like, and that would work through the controller port on an Apple II for a game idea I have, and I wish the Apple II just used a four-way on and off thing instead of these potentiometers. It's nonsense. I've come to hate the Apple II joystick interface.
Yep. I think that's, you know, among Atari people, that's kind of the consensus about the Atari 5200 that came out in the early 80s. That was, in terms of, like, its internals, it's identical to the Atari 400-800 series. But the controllers it shipped with were these analog controllers. And most of the games were the same kind of games you'd have on Atari 400-800. And so the analog controller was not necessary and was just prone to so many problems and so much heartache. It's just not, for most of the, you know, for most action games, it's really not worth it. It's not worth having, like, that doesn't really buy you anything.
Yeah, for the Apple II, it's because clearly Woz just wanted to make a paddle game. And so it really just wants to be two paddles.
Right.
And so that's why you have a total of two buttons and a two paddles, and we'll say, hey, we can pretend that that's a joystick. One paddle's left and right, and one paddle's up and down, and here's two buttons. And isn't that a great solution? Nobody would ever want to have two joysticks in a computer at once. That's madness.
Yep.
The part of the reason I was thinking about the four-wayness of this is just that, looking at LEDs in a joystick, it seems like it would be a pretty simple little project to make a joystick for an actual Atari that had LEDs that responded, you know, just, you have pressed up, you have pressed down, you have pressed left, right. So you could actually, you know, distract yourself by watching the lights blink while you play.
Yep, yeah, I'm sure that you certainly could. I think the key thing here here though is that this is actually this transparent, translucent case, which you typically did not have back in the day. Although actually, I have one sort of big ass Atari compatible joystick. It's a huge thing with suction cups in the bottom and a huge, nice clicky stick. That's actually not a bad idea for a mod for that. Stick some LEDs in there and light that thing up.
And then close the case around it so you can't actually see them. But
no,
you know
they're there. It's in a transparent case. So you can see all the wiring and stuff inside of it. So it's actually...
Oh, okay. I'm thinking you can just see the glow through the cracks.
Cool.
You're using cool in a way that other people don't use the word cool. But I agree with you.
Excellent.
But I've long since learned that my definition of cool doesn't necessarily correspond to the general use.
Okay, so let's see. There were a couple of things that I wanted to mention. They are auctions that I'm pretty sure will be closed by the time this is out there. But so I think maybe last time or two times ago, we talked about, I think it was Dung Beetles that was from Bob Bishop's estate. And so recently, there have been a couple more things from the estate that have been put on eBay. And so one of them is the Apple Vision Source. It would be nice if we could have gotten some kind of actual kind of confirmation history or, you know, like what exactly this is. But it's a cassette tape that says Apple Vision Source, and it has a printout of, you know, assembly. The Apple Vision is very early demo that Bob Bishop wrote. I think he may have just sort of written it independently and sent it to Apple, and they liked it so much they included it on their System Master. But, so it draws a little house and a television, and then has this little guy dance on the screen and says Apple Vision. Maybe it doesn't even say Apple Vision. I think it does, though. So it's an iconic program, and this is quite possibly the cassette the source was stored on and a printout of that source, which is really quite something. And I'm not gonna participate in the bidding on this because I think that it's gonna go relatively high, but it's interesting to see it at least.
This is the kind of thing that I kind of wish would get bought by like archive.org or something, or like somebody who's gonna archive it rather than just an individual. But yeah, it's up to $41 for this cassette at the moment. The printout I find almost more exciting than the cassette itself. I think it'll go for quite a bit. I also won't be bidding, but I hope it doesn't just get thrown in a drawer and never seen again.
Yeah, I know that there are some people who kind of collect cassettes and things that are going after this more seriously, and so there's no point, first of all, in my interfering. And I am hoping that it goes to those who make things like this available to.
Or who at least also back it up, take high-res scans of the printout, like just sort of save it, just in case.
Right, right. Let's see, and so there are a couple of other things that are also being listed among, you know, sort of things from Bob Bishop's estate. It's interesting to just take a look at it. I think I will not continue to go through them, but it's worth following the link in the show notes and just sort of looking to see what comes up, because if nothing else, it's interesting just to see the photos of these things. So the actual auction pick I want to do, there's a manual that's been actually listed for a while that says Vintage Three-Dimensional Computer Graphics Basic Language First Edition First Print 1977, and it's this blue thing. I think it's kind of interesting. It might just be worth what it's being sold for, but so there isn't much description of this, but I sort of recognize this as being essentially the manual for the first 3D system that Sublogic, who, you know, Bruce Hartwick, Sublogic, who went on to do Flight Simulator and many other things in that line. At the beginning of the Sublogic era, I think this in fact started from Bruce Hartwick's like master's thesis or something like this. He wrote a set of 3D routines and then marketed them in a couple of different versions. So there was a basic one, and this is the manual for the basic one. And then there were some other I know there was a 6502 one. I think there was another one for, I don't even know what, 6800 or something. This is from 1977, and it is printed in the somewhat familiar Sublogic font. So it's a neat thing. I think it is actually scanned out there in the world. You could possibly get this and scan it better, but it is sort of an interesting artifact, and so I kind of wanted to point that out. Right now, it is being listed for $22.50, and to me, it would be like $4 shipping.
I think that looks. I didn't know about this, and I'd like it. Maybe I would be just as happy with a scan, to be honest, but I'd love to read this.
Yeah, it's interesting to, you know, it sort of goes through, at least some of these do. I'm not sure if it was this one, but I've read some of these, you know, documents for the documentation for these 3D routines that go through kind of like how clipping works. And, you know, in fact, actually, the 6502 one, it has almost kind of like a programming language that you write it in. It's you give it a bunch of instructions as to, like, you know, go here and draw a line to here, and then draw a line to here, and then go here and draw a line to there. And, you know, so it's first of all, there's just no way you can use this without having the manual in front of you, because it is really just a bunch of opcodes, essentially. But it's interesting to see how this problem was solved. Makes you respect the flight simulator even a bit more. You know, normally I just look at it and think, this is really slow, but it's doing some interesting stuff. Okay, anyway, I think that's the end of the auctions I wanted to mention.
So one of the ones that you've got a link to that you didn't mention, I would still like to point out, there's a letter to Bob,
mm-hmm.
and in that auction, and what most people find interesting, I think, are the discs and the letter and all that. But for me, there's a $25 gift certificate from Apple. And I've never seen this gift certificate format before, where it's like a case, and you can tell that there's a cutout and there's a slid in part, and it's a great design. And I love old Apple marketing material from that time, like those little things, like the stand ups and the cutouts, and in this case, a gift certificate. And I've never seen this gift certificate format before, and I really, really like it. So I would suggest people who are interested in that kind of marketing collateral from vintage Apple stuff, it might be one that you hadn't seen before. So you should check out that auction too.
Yes, yes. Interesting. You know, that just passed me by. You're talking about this thing that's like a card with the...
Exactly, and you kind of see with the shadow that it's a slide-in part. I'd love to see that taken apart. I want to see more details of this gift certificate.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, so whoever wins this, make it available or let us know. Or
yeah, because I've never seen that format. So it's clearly an Apple original thing. It's just, it's not a format I'd seen before.
Yeah, and very, very interesting stuff. Very, very sad about Bob Bishop, but very interesting to see the stuff he had.
On that gift card, I wonder if the thing we're seeing is not a slide-in, but an apple-shaped cutout, that if you fold it open, that rainbow pattern is simply what's on the inside of the card.
I do think it is. I think that the part of the rainbow is a second thing, whether it's the back of it, or I think it's a card that slid in there that also has the rainbow pattern, so it lines up. I don't know. I really want to see more. So it's bugging me. I've been looking at this auction, and I'm like, I really want to see more about that gift certificate. And then I'll go try to redeem it.
Yeah, right. Okay. I think we've made it to the end. It's what we haven't... I think we may have just about hit an hour and a half.
Sure.
Oh, well. So let's see. I guess we're at the closing discussions point. So Carrington, you have something that you put down here.
Yeah, just one little thing to throw in. It's not. I mean, I guess it's like a bonus piece of news or what have you. It's just a link to a movie, and it's really worth watching. So I guess there's this company called Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill, and they're a big architectural design firm. I guess they're doing the new big tower in New York, and they've done a ton of things. I don't know a lot about architecture, so I don't know the firm, but they're supposedly one of the world's biggest. Anyway, way back years ago in 1984, they made a computer graphic model of a bunch of cities. And so there's Boston, Washington, Chicago, Denver, Houston, Portland, San Francisco, and Los Angeles. Oh, and New York. And this video plays it. And so you look at it, and they're kind of those line drawing vector graphic versions that you would have seen in movies in the 80s or just like something right out of Tron. And it's really beautiful to look at. Love this graphic style. So if you like that kind of flyover of a fake city but modeled on a real city vector line graphic thing, if you dig that the way I dig that, then this is definitely worth watching, including right through to the end credits. It's a very good watch. So I'm recommending it, and I'm throwing a link in the show notes.
Yeah, it did. I did sort of look through it a little bit when you posted it, and it is pretty impressive, and it's actually also pretty scary to think of how long that must have taken to render.
Oh, and to do the modeling and all that back in the early 80s? Crazy.
Yep. So, yes, I guess speaking of the 3D flight simulator, this is exactly that stuff. No clipping, though. You just see through everything.
Yeah. Yep.
Jack, do you have any thing to add, or have you been outside the whole time?
I've just been outside. I'm still outside.
Yeah, actually, that'll be nice. At some point, maybe, you know, the Wi-Fi will be reliable enough I can go and sit outside. And
it's still cold here in Toronto. I don't understand. It got really warm for a while, and now it just dove right back to cold. I feel like I'm living in Narnia. It's always winter. I don't understand. Like, it's driving me crazy. I need it to warm up.
Yeah, that'll be true for, you know, a little bit, and then all of a sudden it'll be too hot.
And then I'm going to complain about the heat.
Right. It's just never right.
See, the outside in me, we really just don't get along that well.
Let's see. Yeah, and I'm not sure. I don't know what I've mostly been just kind of like moving things from one place in my office to another place in the office, and it hasn't really been all that active, but I don't know. Okay, so I guess we have basically reached the end of the show. So that's it. Thanks for listening. You can find the show notes for all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss in the forums at vintage-computer.com/vcforum. You can follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast, or you can send us feedback, which we will read now, to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We read them before, but we'll talk about them. We're also a member of the Throwback Network at throwbacknetwork.net. And if you have a chance, please write a review on iTunes, and that will help other people find the show. Until next time,
hello, Chuck Peddle!